From Paul's house and Storm's house, it's Paul and Storm talk about some stuff for 5 to 10 minutes, on average.
Easy, crazy rip-offs!
Boner Cat, I'm Paul.
I'm Storm.
I'm Boner Cat.
Easy, crazy rip-offs.
I know I sang it wrong, if you're counting by what the correct lyrics are to the song Good Times from the television show Good Times.
Nonetheless, we're Paul and Storm. We're going to talk about some stuff for 5-10 minutes.
On average, this afternoon, it is Wednesday, January 25th, 2012.
And this is show 124. And the gentleman you heard chime in...
As Boner Cat.
Playing the role of Boner Cat this afternoon.
The pre-show announcement. Ladies and gentlemen, there's a correction to your program. The part of Boner Cat will be played by Josh A. Kagan.
Josh A. Kagan, welcome Yay. To the podcast.
Hey, everybody.
So it's we're in Los Angeles, the city of angels.
Specifically, we're in the home of our friends Kim Evie and Greg Benson, who are on podcast number
something something. But that's Kim in the background, Kim. Typing away and working like the diligent young lady she is.
And there's Greg Benson.
Hey guys, I just want to say I'm not invited to be on your podcast, so I'm not going to interrupt you. I'll just let you do your thing.
Well, awesome. We'll edit this later. Don't worry about
okay,
it.
Okay, great.
Yeah, cool. Go away, Greg.
Okay, all right, out of here.
Hey guys, what did you think of my Greg Benson impression?
That was amazing.
Thank you. I've been working on it for a while.
It's like he was like right here.
Yes.
It kind of sounded like your Boner Cat to me, though.
the man of one voices.
So, Boner Cat, yes.
Well, let's get right to it. First of all, the reason this whole Boner Cat thing is coming up is because we asked for recommendations for things to talk about with our friend Josh Kagan. And the first response out of the gate was just... Boner Cat.
I honestly can't remember if that's something we mentioned, joked about, or talked about on a previous podcast.
It wouldn't surprise me if it's something that we talked about, but we have no recollection of it, but we find it an absolutely charming term.
And it's the front runner for the title of this podcast. Yes.
Yeah. Word to the wise, if you're going to do a search for Boner Cat on Google, best turn Safe Search on.
Yeah.
Learned that the hard way.
Yeah.
Well, since you are dying to know, we've told you his name, and you know that he moonlights as Boner Cat.
we all know that.
We know that. Let's learn a little bit more about Josh Kagan.
I'm Scorpio.
A Scorpio screenwriter, is that?
I am a Scorpio screenwriter. Yes, that's what I have. I'm a serial killer, and I am a screenwriter. Wait, wasn't that... Scorpio is the serial killer
Zodiac,
from...
The Zodiac screenwriter.
Right. I was thinking of the guy from Dirty Harry.
Yeah.
Oh, gotcha.
Or Scorpio from...
General Hospital.
General Hospital,
that's
back
right.
In the heyday.
Yes, of course.
The days of the Ice Princess.
Who doesn't remember that?
And now we've isolated 90% of our audience. You don't mind, though,
so,
if we just catch up on our stories a little
so,
bit.
So first, we know Josh through our close personal friend, Adam Savage, who back in one of the first Wootstocks, I guess it was like the third Wootstock ever,
yeah.
From that first weekend of Wootstocks in Los Angeles, we were looking for people to recruit. To be guests on the show, and Adam said, I know this guy, Josh Kagan, and I think he would be great. And we said,
okay.
I hope so.
Okay. We trust you.
We'll take your word for it, myth boy.
And Josh proceeded to do a genuinely hilarious bit about having to say 15 nice things about a 30-second...
clip of the original Fantastic Four movie.
The Corman.
Yes, the Corman Fantastic Four movie.
Oh, my.
And it was just one of those great out-of-nowhere... And actually, I will say this. It set the bar for an element we like to have in as many Wootstocks as possible of having a person that maybe not many people have heard of or know who they are.
Sure.
Who comes out and just... surprises and slays everybody.
And maybe is also not their main thing being a performer. That have performer's instincts, but it's not their main thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was a drama club nerdlinger for many years and spent 7 years in theater school for college, but hadn't actually been on a stage in 10 years before doing that.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
Absolutely. And
how often have you been back since?
How often have I been on stage since? I have. I hosted Battle Decks at South by Southwest last year. Mike Montero, aka Mike underscore FTW's sort of PowerPoint karaoke thing, which counts. And then just mere days ago, all of us appeared at Bill Corbett's and Joe Scrimshaw's Cinemadness.
That's right, San Francisco Sketchfest.
Yes.
Yep. Let me get to the root of the Kagan. If we can start.
The root of the Kagan is now the
front. Do I need to turn my head and cough?
It helps. If it
just lie back and think of England.
Oh.
So you studied. You actually, I went Shatner on you. You studied for a while, a long while, theater.
I believe, by the way, it's referred to as you took a Shatner.
Okay, I took a Shatner, and you studied of the theater.
Yes, the theater. The legitimate theater.
So you obviously, or it seems like it's something you have always been interested in.
I've always been interested in writing. I used to do my home. I was a terrible student, and I did all of my homework on our family computer, which was the TRS-80.
Sure. Yes.
And to make sure that I was working, my mom would sort of police the computer room and make sure she heard typing. Mm-hmm. I soon realized that as long as I was just making the sound of typing, I could be writing anything. And then from there, I started writing like sketches and stories and monologues and ended up winning like a couple of high school playwriting competitions and realized this beats working.
Right.
And stuck with that for the rest of my natural life.
For your seventh grade script of a Knight Rider episode.
Yes. Yes. Actually,
seventh grade Knight Rider spec script.
Embarrassingly, I wish it was something that cool. Embarrassingly enough, the first actual play that I ever wrote was an Eric Bogosian rip-off one-person show called Sex, Violence, and the American Way.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, and it was like when Fred Armisen makes fun of one-person shows. It was like, oh, yeah. Here's the wise homeless lady and this slick televangelist.
So you were like, but this was like a lame teenage 80s Anna Deavere Smith.
Yes, exactly.
Except this was like 1953 before it had been overdone. You were ahead of your time.
Yes, it was 1953. We had just gotten out of the war. Mm-hmm. Things were looking up.
And Ike was in the White House.
Yes, Ike was in the White House, and there was a demand for one-person shows from overprivileged white teenagers.
Now, Paul and I have talked to death about our big inspirations and sort of the lodestones and the touchstones, all the stones that we go back to all the
time.
You
got a lot of stones.
You got stones, Josh Kagan.
You got right back at you, Storm.
I want to learn about your stones. Were there particular TV shows or films or anything that were sort of the, when I'm doing anything, I'm sort of measuring against that, or how have they evolved?
I can sort of walk us backwards into this story with an anecdote from my first year of theater school. We were all sitting around being terribly, terribly annoying theater kids. All
is there
of us,
any other kind?
None whatsoever. Drunk.
Right.
Drunk. There's annoying freshman year and then drunk after sophomore year and slightly
there's less. Annoying drunk. Annoying gay, annoying drunk gay, annoying drunk straight, annoying drunk.
And then just waiter.
Yeah, and wait.
Yes, that's the end game.
That's how they wrote Fame, by the way.
Fame, I'm gonna be a waiter.
Maybe I'm gonna be gay.
Fame!
I'll get tricked into doing some porn.
But is anyone ever really tricked into it?
No.
You know when they hand you the mustache and the pizza box.
You're just tricking yourself.
Yes, if you know what I mean.
In the soul.
Ooh.
The soul in your butt.
This is a high five.
That was said for the benefit of the podcast, yes. But I think from now on, whenever we high five in person, we have to precede it by
this
saying,
this is a high five. So anyways, the story. We were all sitting around and kids were, 17 and 18-year-old kids were like, well, I was inspired by the works of Shakespeare. I was inspired by Chekhov. Or I had an acting teacher when I was five. And it sort of got around to me, like, why do you do this? Why are you here? And the answer I honestly gave was, oh, well, when I was growing up, I used to watch The Muppet Show all the time.
Yeah.
And it looked like so much fun to, like, be backstage and be making things for people that's why I do this.
And The Muppets' roots?
Chekhov. Yes, exactly. If a pig goes off in the first act,
you show a chicken in the first act.
Yes,
it must lay an egg by the end of the play.
If you see a boomerang fish, I did theater as a kid and, you know, throughout college because it was sort of a means to an end. I knew I wanted to perform things or write things for other people to perform, but there wasn't access to, like, magic pocket cameras and things of that nature, so it all sort of amounted to standing in front of people on your high school stage and going, I got lots of problems about my parents' divorce or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's all kind of, like, Muppets, Warner Brother cartoons. I worked in animation for a while, which was sort of the culmination
which we'll,
of all
we'll
that
get to.
Yes. What else? Or sort of Marx Brothers, the airplane movies, mm-hmm. Monty Python, for my more serious stuff, I was a big John Hughes nerd growing up, as I think most people who grew up kind of in that era were, which is why I kind of bounce back and forth from broad, wacky comedy, like the thing we can't talk about that
maybe.
We're not.
A lot of bleeps in this.
Beep boop beep boop. Or movies like a box office failure, Band Slam, which
we'll get to,
which was touching and unseen. So that's kind of my deal. Muppets, mostly Muppets.
Now, in terms of professional writing, was the cartoon that you worked on, and please do talk about it, the first, your entree?
That was my first real industry gig, which I got right out of grad school, which, by the way, happens to everybody who goes to theater school for playwriting. You're handed a job right out the door.
Right.
I was the junior writer in development at MTV Animation. Mm-hmm. Which is to say, it was my job to sort of work with the various drawologists and weirdos who kind of came in and was like, I got this great character, it's a talking bucket. And then you'd be like, well, what do you want him to do? I don't know, smoke weed? Okay, well, let's sit down. And it would be sort of my job to explain to them what three-act structures were, what dialogues were, and character.
Right. You cannot build an entire universe around a dope-smoking bucket.
Although now that we've said it out loud, I feel like we're not too far off from an Adult Swim show.
Could be our project.
And that's how I met a kid named Pete Williams, who had actually won a contest 2 years before to have the next big MTV animated show.
Bucket Wanna.
Yeah. And it was a show about he and his friends in college and being nerds. And I worked with him on it. We turned it into a show called Undergrads. Mm-hmm. And in 2001, 11 years ago now, Jesus Christ, it made its debut on MTV. And that was kind of the first real thing that I had done.
Now, did you find it was a stretch for you to write for cartoons versus writing for, you know, these people are going to be on stage or on screen?
For the none of you out there who have seen it, it's actually a pretty, I don't want to say realistic, but it is a very grounded show as far as animation goes.
Yeah.
And again, kind of, you know, broad and wacky in places, and then kind of like John Hughes-y and sweet and coming of age. So it wasn't that much of a stretch. And if anything, I tend to write, my first drafts always tend to be pretty broad and cartoony no matter what I'm writing.
The Muppet grounding.
Yes, it's the Muppet grounding. And so my rewriting process is generally sort of a paring back and like, oh, I guess his eyes can't pop out of his head because that would be something that we'd have to deal with.
Right,
you know, surgery and
happen.
Yeah, something like that. But
and in a soap opera, it's just not appropriate.
I would love to write on a set. Not that soap operas exist anymore. They're getting canceled left and right.
At least not in the traditional form.
Yeah. But what I've always thought that would be a cool gig.
Yeah.
I actually really miss writing in TV. There's that sense of sort of being in the trenches together and you've got to turn something out by the end of the week.
Mm-hmm.
I thrive under that kind of pressure because otherwise it's just a lot of couch and how it's made.
Right. Buckets and marijuana.
Yes.
I'm gonna jump back to process because it actually something that you said. David Kay, whose Twitter handle is WhereAmI89, asked about writing music. So I'm gonna bring it around. But do Paul and Storm, do we write by ear or do we notate, do we apply theory? Our answer is, of course, we do it pretty much entirely by ear.
Yeah, by way of coming out of our ass.
Yeah, it just sort of, it does spontaneously generate. Now, Josh, you have studied theater and writing. Do you find when you write that there are times, or entirely or not at all, that you are applying theory, or is it pretty much at this point you have digested all of this and you are just doing?
You know, honestly, it depends on the project. There are times when I can sit down and just sort of write the stuff that's in my head and it'll come out cohesive.
Yep.
And then there are other times where I go, all right, I need to sit down, I need to block all of this out, I need to write a treatment, I need to put scenes up on index cards and kind of go through that whole thing. I've always had a very, for better or worse, and it's not even a brag, or I hope it doesn't come across as one, I've always had a pretty distinctive voice as a writer.
Yeah.
Even from, like, my, you know, kind of earliest days writing as a teen. And then from there, it's just been a refinement process.
Sure.
And I studied the science of writing as far as just sort of opening up scripts, opening up screenplays, and sort of taking them apart and putting them back together again. Learning how to field strip a screenplay, as it were. So I have all of that as a basis, and I think I'd be lying if I were to say, but you don't need it. You don't need to study writing. You can just, you know, open up a book. For me, it was invaluable. And I probably would have gotten, hopefully would have gotten to the same point that I am now, but the training that I had at the time, it was absolutely good to have. And it's perfect for getting out of scrapes.
Right.
If your brain, or if your heart rather, has written you into a corner, then, you know, your brain and sort of the knowledge that you've accrued can kind of get you out of it.
Right, so it's nitrous that you have, this tank of nitrous.
Yes.
That you can just hit the button and your brain goes, pew!
Yes, were this a David Cronenberg movie, there would actually be a button hardwired into my brain that I could just push.
That would look like a vagina.
Yes.
Which may or may not be our project together.
Right. Which, exactly. Vagina button. Coming
now,
soon.
You were in New York when you were working for MTV, is that correct?
Correct.
I know, so I'm only asking facetiously, but you don't know, so I'm going to ask.
When he says you don't know, he pointed at our recording device.
That's right.
And then our recording device shrugged. It was like, what?
Triple high five.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, very white.
Oh, good job. No, that was great, guys. Man, I wish everybody could have seen that.
I saw it. It was good.
Yay!
We impressed a girl.
How long were you there, and what drew you to L.A.?
I was in New York for 10 years, and
you're an East Coast guy.
Besides Boston, I never left the New England / tri-state area. And my wife and I were definitely those kind of New Yorkers who were like, you can't get a bagel at 4 o'clock in the morning? Yeah. Boo! Los Angeles, stupid people with their lip implants and pectoral... I don't even...
Then I'm picturing this on a billboard as your...
Well, this Kenneth Cole ad campaign is taking a strange turn.
With his lips and bagels.
Lips and bagels. They're cops. I was working on a cop show near. What brought me... I actually sold my first screenplay before I had ever set foot in Los Angeles.
Fantastic.
And as a side note, if you're in Los Angeles for the first time and at a cocktail party with other writers that you've never met before, don't say that to people because then everybody just sort of, you can see smoke coming out of people's ears. We ended up moving here for my work because I was going away for a week, 2 weeks at a time. It's all very pragmatic. It's not like there was a point where I was like struck and fell in love with the magic of Los Angeles per se.
Did you think you were just going to be here for the duration of this project or just decided on...
There was no one project. It just got to... Basically, I was spending about a month at a time away from my wife. Mm-hmm. And so that coupled with like, it's expensive to rent apartments and cars and things of that nature. I took the missus aside and I was like, all right, so let's just... For convenience sake, and so we can be together, and so I can be close to where work is for the time being, we'll do like 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Got an apartment with a 6-month lease. We had our friends sublet our place, and then we got here, and within a week, we were just like, "Oh, it's so nice out!" Like it was the full reverso. Like we were just Los Angeles fake, and then we got here, and it's like, Oh, it's so nice, and the supermarkets don't smell like cat.
Oh, by the way, Greg?
I just wanted to apologize for interrupting you guys earlier. I feel really bad about that.
No, that's okay. No, I was going to ask you to come back in for a second, because I wanted to remind you that you're still not invited to come talk on the podcast.
Oh, okay, yeah. No, that's fine. It's not going to happen again. I just want to let you guys know.
Okay, thanks, Greg.
This will be edited right out, too, so it's not a problem.
Great.
Not a problem.
Yeah, so, you are welcome to chime in, though.
Yeah, anytime.
I don't want to.
Aww.
That's the eternal.
So really, the writing was on the lip and bagel wall that LA was the place for you, pretty much from when it happened.
Yeah, but I had managed to do an okay job of not having to move to Los Angeles. And then, yeah, we just moved just more to see, well, could we do this?
Right.
Could we actually live in Los Angeles? And it turns out we could.
And as we all know, it worked out like a dream with Band Slam, and what you put on the printed page ended up being exactly what they shot.
You know, it's one of those it's one of those things where the more you work in Hollywood and the more you work as a screenwriter, there is never really a chance if it's going to be kind of a big studio-ish movie or just a studio-ish movie, regardless of size. Everybody is going to have their fingers in that particular pie. Everybody's going to get their voice heard. I am very lucky in that while my movie
was...
You make
very hard pies.
Yes.
Very hard to insert a finger.
If you're going to do a search for hard pie, turn safe search on.
Motor cat, meet hard pie.
They are also cops. I am very lucky in that my script was wildly rewritten in the journey into it becoming Band Slam. But it was rewritten by such a talented dude, Todd Graff, who also did Camp and just wrote and directed the pretty wildly successful, considering all, Joyful Noise. He did a real good job with the rewrite, and so while it was different, I was happy to see that it still sort of maintained the spirit of the piece, and is a fun movie, and one you should seek out. Mm-hmm. Or just send me a check for $5. Either way.
Did you have anything that you were particularly disappointed or thrilled with about Band Slam?
There wasn't really anything I was disappointed about, because it was a movie with my name on it that was going to be in theaters and seen by people, which is not a thing a lot of people, not even a lot of screenwriters get that.
Sure.
If anything, I was mostly disappointed that, and this has been documented, Nikki Fink actually, who does Deadline Hollywood, wrote a very nice piece about it. I was disappointed that the marketing was as boned as it was, because it was actually a really nice little movie. 90% top critics on Rotten Tomatoes thought it was, a fine little film. And it was just sort of marketed to the tween Disney-ish audience, and it was kind of neither fish nor fowl and couldn't ever find people who wanted to see it. So
we're layabout musicians and aren't as versed in this. So when you say like the marketing is boned, does that mean like how they would cut the trailers, where they show it?
All of it. They started off by, and so as sort of a backdoor way of saying what I was happy about with the movie. Mm-hmm. I thought both Vanessa and Allie, who were Disney gals, Vanessa Hudgens and Allie Machado. See, the reason why I said their first names was because, not because I have a first name relationship with either of them,
right.
It's because I cannot pronounce Ali Machakla's.
So you're being slick and you've just de-slicked yourself.
Oh, yeah, there's never a shot.
That's why we love you, Josh Kagan. You're real.
I'm the way I walk, the way I move. No, J-Lo?
Not going there. No.
J-Lo and Ja Rule? Nobody? You guys cover it in concert sometimes.
You can't pronounce her last name either, can you?
Lo. I was very happy with the movie in that they cast kind of some Disney-fied girls in it, women from the Disney Channel. Vanessa Hudgens was in High School Movie, and Allie was from the TV show Allie and AJ, and I thought they both actually gave very nice performances indeed. But as far as the marketing being boned, they cast people from the Disney Channel. Mm-hmm. And they made the posters kind of look like the High School Musical posters.
Right.
And it's not, I think, I'm sure very bright 10, 11, and 12-year-olds could find stuff to enjoy about it.
Yep.
But it is really a movie for older kids and their parents. It's very, again, it's sort of, it's very Breakfast Club-y, John Hughes-y in that respect. And they decided to sell it to the younger brothers and sisters of the people who should see it. Or as my friend Steve Sykes once very succinctly put it, they decided to market the movie only to people named Taylor.
Right. do you think that's a function of where, like, demographics are right now? Like, if it was back in the John Hughes era, you could market a movie to that older bracket and make your ducats.
But there were also just less choices for people back then.
Right.
There was no concept of narrow casting. There was no concept that, like, oh, well, this movie that we're making is only for 13-year-olds.
Right. Even the 13-year-olds are going to see the scene where they have the party with the cocaine.
It
doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yes, it was more just sort of like, if it's a PG movie, everybody, and it's a PG movie and it's got teenagers in it, you know, we'll get teenagers, we'll get the slightly older kids, we'll get the slightly younger kids, and now we sort of live in an era of, like I said, like narrow casting,
yeah,
where you can say, all right, we're making this movie for 9 to 12-year-olds.
Right.
That was a real sexy demographic for them. There's a lot of money to be made in tweens. You know, mm-hmm. There's all that disposable income, and most pop music and entertainment seems to be aimed at that demographic right now. So why not jump on that bandwagon?
Is that an age bracket, and I speak a little more broadly, that you really enjoy writing for, and or is there a project that is sort of the dream project you would love to see realized?
Actually, I will say this. The thing that I'm working on right now, this picture, I'm working with McGee's production company, and we just sold this picture to CBS Films, is a picture called The Duff. And it is a teen movie in the Easy A Mean Girls mode.
Yeah.
And so we're definitely aiming for that kind of, we're aiming for that older teen audience.
How did you end up becoming you involved project doing?
I was drinking the strawberries phosphate at Schwab's, and Mick G came by and said, that fat guy should write this heartfelt...
Young man, you've got moxie.
You look like you should write a teen Bridget Jones diary. Well, here's how we're going to do it.
Josh Kagan is real thin.
oh, that's sweet. And you've got a darling little figure as well.
Thank you, honey.
My managers put me up for the gig. I went in, I pitched McGee my take on it, and it was the goodest one out of all of them, I guess. That's the one they liked the most. And then from there, I spec'd it out. I wish there was a more exciting story to this.
But this is new, I think,
yeah,
to a lot of us.
We originally took it out as a pitch, but it's kind of a tough time to sell. And pitching, for those of you who don't know, is when you go out and you do like a little 20-minute one-man show,
right,
doing all the voices and puppets and stuff. And you're like, and then she, you know, and then she's over here and she's sad. And then this song plays and the cute boy smiles. That's all, that's exactly what I did, actually.
And the spec is basically a stripped-down...
Nope. The spec is just the script. It's just you.
Like you've written it, but you haven't been hired to write it. You've written it, and
correct,
now you're trying to get somebody to pay you for what you have written.
You're speculating on a hypothesis, as they said in
sure,
the last
sure.
Crossing. Well, I didn't not get paid for it. McGee's company was very they were nice enough to give me, as a thanks for writing this script for nothing, they gave me a gift certificate to my favorite restaurant.
Aww. That was nice.
Which I did not use until the day we sold the script.
Was that Mozza by any chance?
It was actually where we're going tonight.
Oh,
Animal.
Animal.
Yes. Mm. The meat-based restaurant.
Animal.
I want to eat you like an animal.
Yes, that's what they sing to you as soon as you walk in.
They're a chatty, singy bunch.
Yes. Where were we?
We're talking about your latest project and...
Oh, yeah. So...
Dream project.
It's dreamy in that it's a movie made for older teenagers and will be marketed for that demographic. And I think it's... I hope that it will find its audience... a little easier than Band Slam did.
I have a question.
Hit me.
Because I haven't spoken much yet. So let me chime in. I mean, obviously, work is work, and you'll do what you need to get work. But that aside, like, if you were offered to be a writer on some pre-packaged... Like, let's say Transformers 4 comes around, and looking for the screenwriter for Transformers 4. They need somebody to do a rewrite on... you know, large Hollywood packaged confection project X.
Yeah.
Like, is that a kind of thing you actually would be
interested in? You're the pen in the hand of the studio.
Yeah. Oh, like obvious, I mean, obviously you'd do it. Because who wouldn't turn down that kind of money?
Just for the story alone.
But yeah, like, is that something you actually think you'd be interested in? Like,
because we know a guy who knows a guy.
Oh, okay. We're actually friends with Bumblebee. And he's been looking.
We know Shia LaBeouf, too, by the way. He told me to tell you, no.
Is that a I've actually seen none of the Transformers
That's
movies.
That's pretty much 80% of Shia LaBeouf's dialogue in all the Transformers movies combined.
Well, no, I don't have to see them.
Yeah.
Of course I would take the job because there's so much money, look at it all. And, you know, so I have no qualms about, nor do I even consider the idea of, like, selling out versus not selling out.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I like working and I like doing stuff and I like getting paid for, you know, making jokes and stories.
Mm-hmm.
So I would take it for that reason. I would take it so I could then go to all of my friends who don't do this and tell them stories of the ridiculous Hollywood people and their talking robots.
Yeah.
And I also just, I think more importantly, I just like learning new things.
Yeah.
And I've never worked on a gigantic, crazy, big box Hollywood motion picture, and I'd like to see how that sausage is made.
Then on the other side of this coin, and it could be a multi-sided coin, by the way, would you, like, you did Band Slam for this age bracket, you were doing the Duff. If you became just the guy that you became the go-to guy for doing that, do you fear that you could be pigeonholed there, or would you be very pleased if you became the John Hughes of this bracket?
Tweener John Hughes.
Tweener John Hughes.
I don't... that's just the rest of the podcast. I'll just make that weird Charlie Callis. I aspire to continue to be a working writer, first and foremost. So I don't know if I would say I have aspirations of being the next anything.
Yeah.
I love writing teen movies.
Mm-hmm.
Movies helped me live through my teenage years.
Yes.
And so I think it's kind of it's a mitzvah. You know, if I can write things that will in some way help kids get through their miserable teenage years, that would be delightful. Would I be worried about being pigeonholed? Absolutely not, because, and maybe even like 3 or 4 years ago, I would say yes, because there's a whole entirely other kind of way that I write, which is broader and cartoonier and weirder. But the nice thing is, I am, as a writer and a creative, no longer limited by just selling stuff to studios.
Right.
I have a magic phone in my pocket that can make movies. I can work with other friends outside of the Hollywood industrial complex, and we can do our own weird things. There's Twitter, which, you know, is certainly a momentary distraction, you know, from me when I want to do work, but also it's a way that I can talk to people and sort of show the actual me and do, you know, and write in my voice.
Yeah.
So no, I don't worry about being pigeonholed. And I love the idea if, you know, people are like, oh, we got a teenage coming of age movie. Let's see what Kagan, you know, has to say about it.
Sure. Not a bad thing.
No.
That when someone has a work like that, that they can drop a sack of cash off and you can produce what they need.
Okay, I'm going to change gears entirely.
Hit me.
Yes.
We're going to get out of shop talk.
Great.
And open up the field a little
Good.
Bit. I didn't write down who asked it, so whoever you are, you know who you are. I'm broadening their question. They originally asked, favorite science fiction vacation spot. So I will broaden the question. If you could take a vacation anywhere out of fiction, from film or books or TV... A location that does not exist, but in fiction. Where would you like to take that vacation?
The first thing that pops in my mind? Restaurant at the End of the Universe.
Yeah, that was
took my answer.
Mine too.
Are you guys shitting me?
Unanimous, no.
Three-way high five.
Yeah.
That's a high five.
That's a high five.
That's a high...
I think there were like several thousand other fives happening as we said that. In different times. But, of course, we have time travel at our disposal. So maybe it did happen at the same time.
Yes. I'm I think that would be a dynamite New Year's.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although I don't know if I could do Cal that introduces itself to you.
I would like that. I mean, it does satisfy, I think, the vegan credo, the idea that, you know, you can't eat anything with a face unless it consents. And if this cow has consented, if it is believes it is life mission, wouldn't it be cruel not to eat it?
Yeah, but I'm so anthropomorphic. I'm so animal minded.
Right.
I can't use the word, but you know what I mean. If I saw a talking cow, I'd just want to, like, get a van and solve crimes with it.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't want to eat it then. I'd be like, holy shit, a talking cow! We gotta go solve crimes!
You could eat it as a reward to it for solving the crime.
I guess it does want to be eaten, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it does. I mean, it does.
But then
much
I would...
Much like M&M's, by the way. M&M's just want you
to eat it. For a second, I thought you meant the rapper.
No, no.
Like,
you
I don't
eat
know.
Me.
Because he says yo all the time.
All the time.
That's how rappers talk.
He's just yes. like, yo, 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 rapity, yo, eat me.
And also he is a yo-yo master.
Rapity, yo, eat me.
Rapity, yo, yo, eat me, yo. Eminem. What? Word. Mic drop. Hey, well, let's open this one up to our friend Kim Eby, too. Even though you're working, we're going to distract you. And
yeah.
If you could take a vacation at any fictional locale.
It cannot, science fiction. It cannot be.
No, it doesn't have to be science fiction.
It cannot be a restaurant at the end of the universe.
It could be. It could be non-science fiction-y.
Oh.
Oh.
Like, you know, Middle Earth.
But it has to be vacation?
Oh,
well,
no.
You're going somewhere to visit for more than, like, a day.
Yeah, it could be apocalyptic, too. Don't feel like it has to be pleasant.
Oh, well, the first thing I thought of when you said that, because I didn't know it was a vacation thing, was I thought that I would like to see the battle station from Ender's Game.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
with
yeah.
the mysterious,
you could do like
shifting...
You could do like the equivalent
bridge
of like
tour.
Baseball... like baseball...
Fantasy camp.
Fantasy camp, yeah.
Where
yes.
you get to go play
yeah.
Ender's Game battle thingy.
Yeah. Yeah.
For a week.
So.
Ender's Game battle thingy. That's
Ender's
a front runner.
Hey, Greg Benson. Greg Benson, are you around? Screw that guy. No, he just lost his chance. I was going to ask him a question.
No,
let him officially be on?
Nope. Yep.
He didn't want to.
Screw
he didn't
that
want
guy.
To.
Okay, another question.
I've got a battle.
Okay, battle.
So we do these battles where we pit one thing or person or whatever against another and then choose a battlefield.
Right.
Lolcats versus children's cereal boxes, like the art... Mm-hmm. Then you would find Count Chocula, Coco,
Fruity. Lolcats versus cereal mascots, or you're saying?
The art.
Okay, the artwork. Okay.
The style of art.
Okay.
And the battlefield is which would more likely or sooner become the propaganda aesthetic for a Stalinist state. You know how, like, the Soviet era,
yes.
there was an aesthetic... That when you saw it, it said what it was saying.
Well,
you know,
my first
beyond words.
My first instinct is to say lolcats, but that the art style would be sort of adapted and morphed into a more.
It had to be cats, though.
Spartan
it's still
style.
Recognizably
it
lolcats.
Yeah, yeah, definitely recognizably lolcats. In fact, I think specifically it would be the "I made you some cookies, but I eated them"
mm-hmm.
cat. Because it's sort of a disapproving, frowny face, and they would start using that to associate that you would not want to disappoint the mother government.
So you're saying it's a more effective messaging.
Yeah, I think
device.
So. It's more effective because
cereal boxes.
Cereal art it's always so bright and sunny,
mm-hmm.
but underneath all that and sort of the sugar implied by all of it, I think sort of. Foments discontent among the masses.
That cereals do.
Yeah, that cereals do. And you'll never be able to tear the cereal art away from the sugar rush associated with them, and with that sugar rush comes discontent and a need for change.
Wow, so you have a physio-psychological...
Yeah, exactly.
I would go completely the opposite way with it.
Oh, well, we're going
right.
to have to...
Explain yourself.
Explain yourself.
I think cereal art... Whereas lolcats are for lolcats' sake,
yes.
Cereal art has been scientifically designed by committees and corporations to sell you on a lifestyle, to sell you on a lifestyle and product. Mm-hmm. And if we're talking about, you know, sort of the brightly colored milieu of serial art, you were just saying...
We are, specifically.
We are. Well, then that's aimed directly at children.
Yeah.
That is, so serial art, whereas lolcats exist to just remind you that cats are cute and for some reason can only type in all caps and not particularly well, cereal boxes are this kind of corporate formed thing to sell addictive sugar lumps to our nation's youth. So it seems like it is a shorter hop, skip, and jump from using these boxes to sell kids sugar lumps to selling them on a totalitarian state.
I'm coming down on the side of lolcats.
Sure, your podcast.
I completely agree that cereal boxes, kids in particular, are an effective vector.
It's already propaganda, is what I guess
it
I'm
is.
Saying.
However, I feel that because of the amount of effort that they've put into developing that particular aesthetic, that if you're trying to create a Stalinist regime where all the people were children, and I think that's an awesome sci-fi premise. You know, Logan's Run, but it ends at age 11.
Sure. That's Menudo, actually.
That in that case, I would agree with you. However, for a general populace, I think I agree with Paul. Maybe not for the same reasons, but that it's almost it's very much more Church of the Subgenius, where the Reverend Bob Dobbs, this image, Andre the Giant has a posse, that it isn't specific, but there's a sense that you should be paying attention to it.
Right.
And that the idea of pairing this cat image with text is much more adaptable than the brightness. But I believe there are certainly scenarios in which it could be accomplished.
I guess, and I'm also envisioning that as we go further into the totalitarian reign, the boxes become a little darker, a little more sinister over the... And again, if you can... Obviously, it is not a society that consists entirely of children.
Cool as that would be.
I think once you have their minds on lockdown, everybody else just falls into step. That's why parents consent to buying sugary, disgusting cereals.
I believe the children are the future. Give them cereal and let them fall into a
totalitarian regime.
Yeah.
But I bet we can open this up to the listening public and their powers of Photoshop.
I agree. I think that we have our audience participation moment for this podcast.
I think you are right.
I'm at the end of my notes, and this is about how long we typically podcast.
Yeah, it feels about long enough, I think.
Are we going to do a where are we? If you have anything you would like to pimp or sell or discuss, please do.
This was just announced a couple days ago, but we were speaking of my late lamented cartoon undergrads. Mm-hmm. I am actually going to be appearing along with the show's creator, Pete Williams. He also did all the voices. And Andy Reingold, the story editor, at the Calgary Expo.
Oh, jealous.
At the end of April. And our other friends from the Nerdlinger circle, I understand Mr. Will Wheaton is going to be appearing at this self-same thing.
Fantastic.
And Joel from Hijinks and Sue.
Wow, so people can just go there and just come right up to you and say hello.
I'm not counting on it. The show hasn't been on in a very long time. But but yes, absolutely. I'll be trading high fives for beers.
And now that you know who Josh Kagan is, and he's just as much fun to hang out with as it sounds, please do say hi if you're at Calgary.
Wherever we're in Los Angeles or even just in the same city as each other, we like to think of Josh as our Eaton buddy because we're always mutually up for going to any restaurant anytime.
And we have similar tastes and similar appetites.
Yeah, so.
Love snacks.
Mm. So your Eaton buddy and mine, Josh Kagan. Thanks for joining us.
Good night, America.
So we are, of course, going to be on the 29th of January, which is just a couple of days from now, is Woodstock Founders Night, part of San Francisco Sketch Fest.
Tickets are rapidly diminishing.
Dwindling. There are some left, though. On February 10th, we're at the Birchmere with John Hodgman. Our first non-cruise-based performance with John Hodgman. We're looking forward to that one in our own stomping grounds. On the 17th of February, we're at Backbooth in Orlando, Florida. A big pre-cruise bash. We haven't been to Orlando in a couple of years, but we're looking forward to it. We have a number of other shows coming up. that either just became official and I haven't put them in the schedule yet or aren't quite official enough to announce.
Go to paulandstorm.com to learn how to become part of our Brigade of Minions, which is teaming hundreds of minions.
Yes.
Just poised and ready to wreak something.
Minion-y goodness.
Otherwise, I'm Storm.
And I'm Paul.
I'm Josh A.K.
And we've been talking about some stuff for 5 to 10 minutes.
On average.
Bye-bye!
Bye!
Go do things.